basic case against free will is this. It's twofold. One is that, and again, it's the obverse of this sense of self. It's the other side of the coin, where you feel like you're a thinker of thoughts. You feel like you're the author of intentions. You feel like you are a subject. And commensurate with that feeling is the sense that you are in a position to do what it is you do, to decide to do. I can decide to lift my left hand, or I can decide to lift my right hand, and I can deliberate between the two, and I can have reasons for one or reasons for the other. And I'm in the driver's seat. I really am. And then if you so that's where everyone's starting. The problem with that is, objectively, we know that everything that you're consciously aware of, all your thoughts and your intentions and your impulses to resist those impulses, I mean, however you're, whatever's coming up for you, we know that's all preceded by events in your nervous system of which you're not aware and which you didn't create. And the state of your brain in this moment, it's in every sense, is the product of variables that you are not responsible for. You didn't pick your parents. You didn't pick your genes. You didn't sculpt your genes. You didn't pick the environment in which your genome was going to be expressed. You didn't pick the way the your interaction with the world and other people sculpted the microstructure of your brain so as to give you the brain you have. You didn't pick the number of receptors you have of every type at every synapse. You didn't pick all the charges that are currently in place in your brain at this moment. You haven't created your neurophysiology, and yet your neurophysiology is going to give rise to every next thought and intention that shows up for you.
Is free will possible if God knows all our thoughts and actions beforehand?
I think it certainly is. Some people have adopted a viewpoint called theological fatalism, which says that if God foreknows what you're going to do, then you are fated to do it, and therefore everything happens necessarily. This, however, I think commits an elementary logical fallacy. It reasons as follows. Necessarily, if God foreknows that I will do X, then I will do X. Premise two, God foreknows that I will do X. Three, therefore, necessarily, I will do X. So that's how the argument for fatalism goes. Necessarily, if God foreknows that I will do X, then I will do X. Two, God foreknows that I will do X. Three, therefore, necessarily, I will do X. That commits a fallacy in modal logic. It does not follow from those two premises that you will necessarily do X. All that follows from the two premises is that you will do X, but not that you will necessarily do it. You could refrain. And if you were to refrain, then God's foreknowledge would have been different. So, by acting one way or the other, I have the ability to act in such a way that God's foreknowledge would have been different than it is in fact. And that's sufficient for freedom. There's nothing about God's merely knowing about something in advance that takes away my freedom to do otherwise.
And welcome to the Wait What If podcast. I'm your host, Kevin Sullivan, followed by
Mike.
You always get confused when I point to you. He's always like,
I can't help it.
I think you're under
a
pseudonym.
Good time.
Are you former CIA?
Am I?
He always looks down at his hand. It's written on his hand. He's like, my name is Mike Stojic.
Mike. That's a K, not an L.
And of course, we've talked about this for a couple weeks. So we have Paul, Mr. Paul Adams, joining us, or should we say Master Sergeant Paul Adams, RET USAF. And what else? What are your other accolades?
Oh, that's enough. Retired.
Guru on the mountain. Mountain. Triple black belt in verbal judo. So, if you can pick up by the quotes that I played you, the first one was from Dr. Sam Harris about his thoughts on free will and its existence. And his stance is that it's an illusion, which makes me want to bring something up about that, too. I wish it. Does anyone have a pen? I didn't. Oh, Mike, do you see that one over there? Could
what?
You grab that?
I can.
Thank you. Or Paul might be a little close. No, I think you can get it. So, of course, he says that it's an illusion. Thank you, Mike. And the second one was Dr. William Lane Craig, who is a Christian apologist. So his side of things. And I should have said Dr. Harris is a neuroscientist. So you get your confirmation bias there towards neurophysiology. Dr. Craig is a Christian apologist. So his confirmation bias is obviously towards the theological aspect of it. That's about it. Paul, do you have any introductions you would like to add?
Yeah, I thought I would maybe provide some definition around some positions that are traditionally held by philosophers.
Sure.
Regarding free will.
Can I back up real
sure.
quick for a second? Is it possible with free will that all right, that I purposely played a atheist and a Christian to begin with because there's a lot of theological aspects to that discussion. Does free will necessarily have to go that route, or can it stay strictly with the philosophical?
Precisely, yeah. Now, as you know, I am a Christian, and I'm a theist, but I have not included that part in the equation whatsoever,
okay.
because I do believe that we can talk about free will without talking about the God factor, as
okay.
Bill Craig did mm-hmm. in his quote there.
Someone's cell phone nearby? I hear a little bit of a... I know it's not mine, because I don't know where mine is. I put my phone down, and then I lose it for a few days, and then I find it. I have a work phone, a home phone, work email, home email. I have a wait, what if email. I have too many ways people can get in touch with me, which means my reaction to that is to just never carry anything.
Now, which one of those people with those IDs is free?
Well, like right now? we'll see in a few. Yeah, so I'm sorry.
So yes, I do believe that we can talk about free will without interjecting the theological aspect. That's an interesting one,
mm-hmm.
and one that I've followed for a number of years. But I don't believe we need to talk about that necessarily.
Right. I think it's okay to talk about it. I think
sure.
it's...
Yeah, it's relevant because not everyone's an atheist.
Right.
And, but not everyone is a theist either.
Right.
So.
Right. And do you put theists in the same category as deists? I just learned recently that there's a difference.
Yeah, there is a difference. But that might take us too far.
Okay, yeah, we want to stay on track. Paul's very good at keeping me on track. I email lots of questions, and then he'll say, all right, I liked your email. I see what questions you were asking me, but you brought up about 15 different topics. That's just, I guess, the nature of it.
Indeed. It's the nature of life. It's complex.
Now, Mike, you're mm-hmm. a minor in philosophy. Where do you mm-hmm. see yourself as a philosopher?
Where do I see myself?
Yeah, do you...
As a philosopher?
Yeah, do you...
I'm not a philosopher at all.
Do you read philosophy books?
That hardly...
Yeah, I've seen your collection. Your library is very
That's
impressive.
Right. No, I do. It's been a while, though, since I've read anything in philosophy. I've mm-hmm. been getting involved in other things, but I don't know. I've always been, I guess, fascinated by it. Mm-hmm. So I minored. It was actually a double major for a while, but then... It didn't work out towards the end.
Yeah.
I needed to graduate quickly, so they didn't offer one of the courses. The last course I need, they didn't offer it this semester. But anyways, your question, where do I see myself? I don't know. A hobbyist? Can
yeah.
you be a hobby philosopher? I think that's kind of what you are.
I sure. know. Yeah.
Paul is the pro, so
no.
I mean, we are the hobbyists. We're like the summer league basketball camp, and then he's like the NBA pro.
I'm not. I put on my email or my text to you guys. I said, let's try to keep it as a barstool philosophy.
Yeah,
I think that's
go.
Where I stand.
Okay, barstool philosophy. Sure, that's
yeah.
hobbyist philosophy. It's all the same.
When I attended bar, and this is specifically last time I did it was back right around September 11th. It was after that event. I heard more answers to how to fix the problem in life as a bartender. And I'm bringing that up because people are obviously talking a lot about the September 11th attacks, just from barstool philosophy. Yeah. People, you know, and then after you get a few drinks, your inhibitions drop away, and then
everybody's a philosopher.
Everybody has an opinion on something.
Okay, Paul. So obviously today's subject is free will. The ability for me to say, wake up in the morning and decide that I'm going to get out of bed and either shower first and then go downstairs and eat my Wheaties, or eat my Wheaties first and then go upstairs and shower, or avoid showering altogether. these questions, which seem mundane, but are very fundamental in our life. And I think the reason being is that we're conscious beings. We have thoughts prior to what we do things, and we define those thoughts, which put reason into what we do. Mm-hmm. And when someone starts saying, you know, that might be predetermined, or you go to church and they say God knows everything, and then you say, well, does he know what I'm going to do, you know, in the next 10 minutes? It kind of, it flies in the face of what our reality is, and then obviously it opens up a huge area of philosophy.
Mm-hmm. Indeed it does. It sure does. Yeah, like I had said, there are traditionally three camps. And Mike, please chime in, help me out if you're aware of more. But traditionally there are three camps that that philosophers have come down on regarding free will. Mm-hmm. And what I've done is sort of capture the gist of each of those camps. And two of them will sound very familiar, okay, based on the quotes that we heard from both Sam Harris and William Lane Craig. So the first camp is called determinism. And that's pretty much where Sam Harris would come down on. And so I have a quote here from another person who is a French revolutionary philosopher of the 18th century. And he says, "Man is born without his consent. Nature does not consult him through the course of his life, nor are his habits and dreams his own, as he is unceasingly modified by causes beyond his control, and his will counts for nothing that he does." And that would be Henri d'Holbach, who died in 1789. So that pretty much sums up determinism. Now, in terms of defining determinism, we could say that every choice and every decision is determined by prior conditions and causes not under our control.
Right.
Thus, the past controls the present and the future. The presence of alternative options at the time of deliberation give the appearance of free will, but since the present and future are fixed by the past, free will does not exist, says the determinist. The future is closed, and there is no ghost in the machine, so to speak, stepping in to change the course of any event. Consequently, there is no basis for holding individuals morally accountable for their actions. That, in a nutshell, is the gist of determinism, and is where Sam Harris would come down.
Right.
Now, that has a lot of assumptions that we could perhaps, if we have time, get into and sort of lift up the covers and see what's underneath and what is assumed by that definition. But for the most part, that is traditionally what determinism would hold to. Now, libertarianism would be almost the opposite of that, and yet I have another quote here. So, "There is an unmistakable intuition that every human being is free to deliberate and make choices, and that decisions rendered could have been different, which is why regret and remorse are so powerfully disturbing." So says Corlys Lemont, another philosopher.
Right, and regret and remorse, I never even considered that, would have direct implications with free will.
Exactly.
Because if you could choose something, you would regret it.
Exactly.
If you chose what you consider as the wrong.
Okay. Precisely. So we could define libertarianism, or another way of putting that is indeterminism, as the libertarian self is autonomous and stands independent of any external factors that may appear causal and determinative. The past does not control the present nor the future, but instead both are created simultaneously and spontaneously by the free act of the will. The future, therefore, is open, as there is a ghost in the machine who authentically steps in to change the course of events and determine the future. Consequently, there is a basis for holding individuals morally accountable for their actions, according to the libertarian or the indeterminist. Now, those are two opposing views, and if one is true, the other is necessarily false.
Right.
Now, it's possible that both could be false, but once again, if we buy into Sam Harris's position, or Bill Craig's and many others who are libertarians, then we can't, of course, hold to determinism. But if we carefully define determinism, then there's a third view that's sort of a hybrid between the two, and it happens to be the one that I subscribe to, and it's called compatibilism. So to define that, we could say that the compatibilist would maintain genuine human freedom is compatible with determination broadly defined. It is not logically inconsistent to hold that both free will and causation together explain human choice. That said, simply because an act is caused is not to say that it is compelled. Genuine human action is compatible with causal conditions that decisively decisively incline the will without constraining it. Humans, therefore, are morally responsible for their actions when genuine alternatives are available and one could have acted otherwise. There is, in fact, a ghost in the machine capable of making choices that are significantly free and can change the course of events that otherwise would not have instantiated. The question of whether the future is open or closed for the compatibilist is a non sequitur for us, and therefore is irrelevant. So that's a third position. So once again, just to sum up, we have determinism, we have libertarianism, and then we have a hybrid between the two, compatibilism, given that we carefully define what we mean by causation and determinism. So that's sort of a general framework. So much for bar talk.
No.
Oops.
That's good.
That gives us a framework from which we can begin to unpack this and talk about it.
Yeah. And you said you can see yourself a compatibilist in this situation. Mike, where do you see yourself?
Same. I definitely see it as
Is it compatible?
Now hearing these three, yeah. I would have said libertarianism or libertarianist until he told me about compatibilism, and now that's where I'm at. It just seems to be the most logical for me. I do certainly think there are things that are beyond your control, which help push you in one direction or another direction, but I think at the end of the day, you know, ultimately the choice is yours. So there's all these external factors that are maybe require you to go a certain direction, but I think the mind is a bit more complicated than that and is able to pick up on other sources of information that may be coming your direction, and you can take those things that are external to you and then perhaps some other things, and then as a result of that change your course or your direction. So I think that's the way at least I think, just listening to you talk about compatibilism, I mean, that's how I feel about it, unless I'm completely wrong, but seems like it makes the most sense to me.
Let me piggyback on that statement a little bit. You've been known to say that the brain, or we only have 10% use of our brain. And the theory out there is that the 10% that we perceive that we use is the part that we're conscious about, and that the rest of our brain is actually working in the background.
I've heard that too.
And with that said, there is a ton of information that's being processed without us even knowing it. You know, external stimuli, things in the past, genetic components. The person who acts a certain way because they have an anxiety syndrome based on genetics or a mental health issue, or same sense, will act and will move and will act in ways that you and I wouldn't. And if that is happening in the background, and they're only conscious of basically their actions, they're almost conscious witness of their actions. And what I mean by that is,
Well, that speaks to Mike's point, I think, and that is that the mind is complex. Now, one of the things that I ran throughout each of these three definitions is this motif called the ghost in the machine. Mm-hmm. And basically...
What does that mean? Is that...
Well, yeah, what that means is that there is a substance inside of us that is different from our physical material body. Mm-hmm. That there's something in us.
Right.
Now, for Sam Harris, being a neuroscientist, not all neuroscientists believe this, but some do, and Sam Harris certainly does, and that is that there is nothing mental about us. All our mental processes and brain states are physical connections.
Right.
That's all they are. There is no deeper subject or agent underneath it all, the essential I. Mm-hmm. In Freudian terms, we call it the ego or the ego. The essential I making the choice or being inclined toward vis-a-vis away from a particular option. And so the ghost in the machine works for both the libertarian and for the compatibilist, but there is no such animal, so to speak. There is no such entity as a ghost or a mental property that's not material. For the determinist. So for the hard determinist. Now, not all determinists believe that. Mm-hmm. Again, there's lots of different permutations of this, but nevertheless, you know, the essential self or the mental consciousness, while it involves the physical aspect of our brain, and indeed our brain is Descartes would argue our brain, actually he'd argued the pituitary gland, but he was wrong, we later learned. But nevertheless, there is a bridge between the external world, starting with my body and everything outside of it, and my mental process. There is some sort of bridge, and the brain, I would offer, is that bridge. Unfortunately, what all neuroscientists can do is look at the brain and measure it.
Right.
You know, they can't look at the essential I. They can know that I feel pain, but they can't know whether I like it or not.
Right. And therein lies the great question in life. I mean, I suppose they can measure your dopamine response. They can measure the pleasure centers of the brain and see what's going on there. They've done fMRI studies on individuals where... they put them in front of, I don't remember the whole, I had my notes, but they did fMRI, which is a special type of MRI. It's almost a live action MRI of your brain, and they can see what lights up. Mm-hmm. and they can actually map out what's going on in there. And they had people do a task, and I think it was hitting a button when, oh no, they had to choose whether they want to hit the blue button or the green button. And they could choose at any time. The only construct was you had to look at this clock. It was a general clock that everyone else had, and note the exact time you decided to do it. So red, green, I'll do it now. 1:05:38. Mm-hmm. I chose green. What?
Nothing.
I want to hear. I want to hear your.
No, I'm listening. I want to hear the story. I was thinking in my mind, and you saw me make a physical reaction because I was thinking so hard.
I have something to add to that too. The news that came out today about that.
I'm just interested. So I was like, huh? Because I well, now that since you asked me and I've interrupted, I was like, me? If you said, Mike, push the red or the green button. Look at the clock when you and note when you. I'd be like, I'm not going to push any of the buttons. I just don't care enough to push any of your stupid buttons. So what about that decision?
You know, then you would be excluded from the study. They're looking at the decision process.
But that is a decision. Not to not hit the button is just as much a decision to hit the button. So,
right.
I mean, if they told me you're going to sit in this room for 15 minutes and then you push the button however many times you want, but when you do push the button, note the time, maybe I'll sit there for 15 minutes and at 14:59, that's when I decide to hit it just because I'm like, just for giggles.
Is that your phone?
Yeah.
Your phone's going crazy.
I have a lot of notes on Evernote, an app, which requires
that's a great app.
A cloud.
It's iCloud, fine. You know, it doesn't.
Cloud.
What? So, it's more than fine. It's an elephant.
No, I'm talking about the...
It's an elephant.
I was talking about the feedback.
The logo's an elephant. Oh.
I thought you were saying it's an elephant in the room.
No.
Poor Paul's sitting there.
No.
That's more than fine.
it's an amazing.
You're ruining art. No. So.
Just for giggles. Like, I understand but what if you get a guy like me who's like, oh, these guys are trying to be serious, and just for giggles. I mean, that's still. I still had to make a decision not to push the button until 14:59, and then I'll hit it, and then you note it, and they say, "Why'd you make that decision at 14:59?" Well, mostly because I'm playing games with you guys. I don't know, just because it was fun to do.
Don't care when you
maybe I never hit it. And then
The idea was they were looking at when you consciously decided to hit the button
or not hit it, right?
Or not hit it. I guess they could measure that, and then they looked at whether. They looked at if there was any predicting values prior to that, and there were. There often were. It was like 80% of the time they could predict with certainty whether you were going to choose the red button or the green button.
That 80%, though, I think falls in that compatibilism, because there's 20% of the time they couldn't determine that, so right, there might have been other external factors. So I think that just plays probably more to the compatibilism band camp than it does.
My study, I'm just kidding.
Oh, I don't know. I thought we were discussing this.
What's going on?
Are we going to fight
out of my house?
Oh, I'm out of here. I thought this was supposed to be a discussion. Am I wrong, Paul?
No,
tell me I'm dumb, and I'm
not
and I'll
at
leave.
All. Not at all. The desire to think that you chose of your own free will to push the button at any given time, the determinists would simply argue there's a series of causes and conditions prior to that actually led you to do that. And many of those are unbeknownst to you.
The majority, 90%, is in your...
Oh, indeed. There's no... I mean, it's an infinite regress of causation, you know, according to that. But... as the compatibilists would say, is that just because there's a series of conditions and causes that led up to you making that choice, such that that choice would have been chosen. Notice I didn't say must have been chosen. That's fatalism, which is tantamount to Sam Harris's view. But
right.
Would have been chosen is not inconsistent with you. The essential you as a ghost in a machine making that choice vis-a-vis other alternatives available to you to do nothing, as you said, or to push a different button. Or to kick the person next to you, for that matter.
Yeah, maybe that's what I should be doing.
So just because there's a set of causes and conditions prior to you making that are in the chain of causation, if you will, and you are not able to step outside of that chain, does not mean that you did not choose to remain in it, if that makes any sense.
I think so. I feel like you I think so. But what you're saying is, I mean, that still falls into the compatibilism.
Yes.
Okay, yeah. So that makes sense to me then, because now I know I understand that.
Now, the libertarian would say that those causes and conditions external to you, be it your environment or anything else outside of your... And to be fair with libertarians, they do not maintain that all choices are libertarianly free. That is, free will is exercised at every instance. Because they do give credence to internal pulsations and inclinations and desires, okay, as to what moves or motivates the will to do X as opposed to Y or not X. So they do give credence to an internal cause, but the external cause is what the libertarian does not ascribe to. There is nothing external to the person that causes them to have to make that choice. That's libertarian freedom. Hmm. It only pertains to external causations and conditions.
Okay. The definition of free will says the ability to, let's just say, choose one's actions without coercion or constraints. So, to basically say, I'm going to go left, or I'm going to go right. Nothing is coercing me to do this. There's no constraints in preventing me from doing this or encouraging me to do this. It is my sole choice.
Well, may I offer
sure.
a sort of a nuanced version of that?
Okay.
Definition. If you were a bank teller and a robber stepped in front of your face, pointed a gun at you and said, give me all the money, you are compelled to do that. Now,
right.
Granted, you don't have to, but chances are you want to. because you value not only your life, probably the life of many others as well.
Right.
So you against your will, you comply. So your ability to comply was constrained by the conditions. So even though you wanted to do otherwise, the libertarian would say you're still free because you had an inclination to do otherwise. That is to keep your job and keep the integrity of the bank and all that. But you were constrained by external conditions that forced your will to do contrary to what you wanted to do. So you said the definition of free will is the ability to do otherwise. So free will doesn't just pertain to action. It also, in abilities, it pertains to what's going on inside as well. And we kind of have to keep that in mind when we talk about free will.
Okay.
Because I do all things all the time against my will. I swam 20 laps today, and I didn't want to. You know, and you probably lifted more weight than you really wanted to at any given time.
Well, when I hurt in the morning, I
is that
so? So I want to do this?
Yeah.
So you
had pizza I ate yesterday. I didn't want to. Right?
I have the feeling you know where I lean towards on these three. Any guesses?
Determinism.
Determinism. I don't want to be a determinist. I truly don't.
But you've been pre-wired and whatever. As long with
there's a lot of my beliefs that I often tell my wife. I'm like, you know what? I would love to think that way. It would be wonderful, but I can't. I would love to, but
you're not free to.
I guess
that's,
not.
That's true.
Yeah.
That is true.
Then. Because, and I love to use this term, you know, sticking feathers up your butt doesn't make you a chicken. You can walk around with these.
Sure.
That's from Fight Club. We bring up, what's his name again?
Brad Pitt?
No, the author of Fight Club.
Chuck Palahniuk?
Yeah. Chuck Palahniuk.
Chuck Palahniuk?
Palahniuk.
Palahniuk?
We got into this discussion.
I feel like it's Palahniuk.
I think it's Palahniuk.
Let's get him on the show.
Wouldn't that be great? Yeah. You want to talk about, I would call him a industrial modern age philosopher, unrepentant to the human condition.
Jesus Christ. That's insane. I just like his books.
Yeah. Well, his books are very unflinching.
They're raw.
His books explore the deepest, darkest areas of the human mind and lay them out there. He does not candy coat anything. And I think it's why he has such a good following, because there's refreshment in honesty.
Honesty not expressed in love is brutality. So something to chew on.
Have you ever, I find that most of the most interesting biographies I read or autobiographies are the most honest, because it's the person tells you like it is or sure. tells their story with an unflinching, unbiased approach to their life. And it's pretty,
I was just thinking,
yeah,
sorry, while you were talking.
No, it's okay.
Because I was just thinking, but why this determinism thought, and then my view is more compatibilism, and I kind of look at, you know, our different lives, and I get the sense, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but that this is exactly what you want: this house, the family, the job, like that's what you want.
Sure, yeah.
This is not what I want. Like I'm. The suburban life is not really for me, honestly. And I had this conversation with my wife, and I'm like, I'm not one of these guys. Like I have a different background, and there's just things that I want to go do. And I just want to run and explore and do all these sorts of things. And it's a strong, strong pull that wants me to just take off. But I don't, I stay here. And the reason I stay here is because of Jamie, my wife, because I care so much for her. So, and her, what she needs and her, you know, what she wants to build. But honestly, if it wasn't for that, if she wasn't my, I'd be gone.
Sure.
And who knows where I'd be. But I still have that pull now. So at any given moment, I'm like, man, you know, I get this huge desire where I'm, I could get out of here. But it's such a strong pull. But then I have these other influences that are keeping me here. But it's a battle. And for me, inside, that's the way I'm able to see this, because I don't want that house in this neighborhood. This, even though I like you guys a lot,
we all live in the same neighborhood,
but you understand, like, this isn't where I feel comfortable. I'm more comfortable being gone and doing another things. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And that's kind of why I feel like this compatibilism is kind of it. Cause yeah, man, there are certain things that are, you know, external factors, and then like things that were pre-wired into me through my parents because of maybe the way they were and maybe the way their parents were and all those sorts of things. But I still made a decision, and in my mind, it's a sacrifice to live here, even though it's like any normal guy would be like, why wouldn't you? I mean, you have an amazing house. You live in an amazing neighborhood. You have amazing neighbors. You know, you got a really great life. And in fact, my mother-in-law told me, she's like, you know, Mike and Jamie have like the storybook type life. And I think to most people, that's probably true. But to me, I don't think it's true at all. But it's a constant struggle, you know, to maintain this sort of thing, if that makes any sense. So in my mind, because there's this huge struggle, it can't possibly be determinism, because it's just, it's too much. It eats me up. And that's why sometimes I disappear on different trips just to get out. Does any of this make sense?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, one of the faux pas, I think, of determinists is, that, and C.S. Lewis said this, in order for love to be meaningful, it must be freely given. Now think about that. Anything that is given under the auspices of love that is not freely given is given under constraint or under compulsion. And who among us would want that? That's nothing short of rape. Be it psychological rape, if not, you know, not physical, but psychological rape. And I don't know that any of us would value that as much as if the spontaneity of love were to be able to be expressed from an essential self, which I've called the ghost in the machine. There's something in the person that's beyond the material, physical, tangible person that is giving themselves to me. And they're doing it of their own free will. And that, to me, makes love flourish in ways that otherwise it's just one big machine that's under operation of cause-effect. And that's that. In other words, love could not be possible in a raw determinist worldview. Now we could call it psychological and social and historical cultural conditioning. Mm-hmm. We could call it that and say, yeah, we had these subjective feelings of love and give credence to them. But at the end of the day, the only thing that exists for the determinist like Sam Harris is the objective, material, tangible, touchable, tasteable world. That's the only thing that exists. Right. There is no other metaphysical world, a world beyond this world. There's no ghost in the machine. There's no essential self. So,
I think...
Does that help?
Yeah, no, I think that's...
So there's
I agree
there's
with
a higher
you.
Order, higher order bent or influence that you have called I Love My Wife.
You're right.
Also known as Jamie, that compels you to sacrifice certain things because you believe at the end of the day, perhaps you haven't expressed it this way, but that it's better for you that you not get everything you want.
No, I think that's very true. Because if I did exactly what I wanted, you guys would probably never see me again. I would be so far gone. But it's not because it's just different. I just want to go and explore and see do different things and not worry about the 9-to-5 and the 401k and all these rules that I'm supposed to follow. But no, you're right. In my mind, you're right, Paul. And it's that I have so much love for her that. I'll make that sacrifice because that means more to me than this could ever mean. I still go with my buddies sometimes.
Sure.
And tear the town up and have a good time. You have to let the wild side out. But I think it's right. What you said at the end of the day, that's ultimately that's what compels me.
How's the podcast going? Or should I not ask?
Okay, you don't have to ask.
Mike is the founder, creator, producer, and financier of the Make It a Double podcast, which you can find on doublepodcast.com.
What is well, that's my well. Oh, there's a few
doublepodcast.com
is the website.
Okay,
where you can just search "Make It a Double" on Facebook. You can search "Make It a Double" on iTunes. You can do those sorts of things and find it. But yeah, no, the podcast is called "Make It a Double." It's about booze, spirits, history, mixology, and the people and stories that really make it great. And we just kind of explore anything about alcohol because I'm really fascinated by it. So right, there's two episodes out right now.
That's cool.
I'm in the middle of editing the third episode. The first one's on moonshine, and we really get after that one. That's pretty neat. The second episode is on craft beer, and the third episode will be on Irish crack. And I hope you're an Irishman, so you should know what crack is. It's C-R-A-I-C. Crack, so for like good times.
Yeah.
Crack means good times.
I didn't know. I never heard that term. That was
really
great.
Yeah. No. When I went to Ireland, our guide, I did a three-day Irish tour, and he was telling us about the Irish crack. He's like, okay, let me tell you how Irish crack works. And we're like, what?
Whoa.
And he's like, no, it's like good time. And he was.
Yeah, you have to say with an accent. You have to give your
Irish crack. Actually, that was terrible.
<It's Italian. laughs> Hey, the meatballs.
The problem is I've been drinking, and now my accents are
Jameson no less.
I like the Irish crack.
Now you sound like me. What's your alter?
Oh, what was it? Something Czeslaw Melnik.
Hello, I'm Czeslaw Melnik.
That's an alternate personality in the podcast.
We're
going to
create
world.
Another show, and I'll be Czeslaw Melnik.
A Russian pub.
But,
yeah.
But it's called Irish Crack, so it's really on traditions, drinking, music. I interviewed some pretty neat people for it. I'm in the process of editing it right now, so I think it should be out in the next few days. I'm pretty excited. That was the most fun to make.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, man. I sat around and drank so much Guinness and whiskey.
Gosh, you know what? There's
so
truth.
Much fun.
There's truth to stereotypes. And that's why people, I think, in general, if you just accept stereotypes and you laugh at them, then it's all good.
You should laugh at everything. I mean, if it's that's. It can't be that serious.
Yeah. It's just
if you can't laugh at yourself.
It's satire on life. And
that's fun.
I mean, yeah, it can get dangerous.
I didn't mean we did drink quite a bit, but it was.
You were saying that all Irish people are. I heard you clearly that all Irish people are alcoholics.
I had such a great time where I was talking to
the Prime Minister of Ireland's a very
he's a good friend of yours.
Yeah, well, no, he likes this show.
Huge
I don't
fan,
know him. Yeah,
huge fan. Makes sense. I believe it though. Everyone is. But no, I was talking to James Olin Oden, who's a local Irish musician, and I went. He invited me to his house to do the interview, and he pulled out his bottle of 12-year Bowmore, is what we were drinking. It's actually a Scotch, but we were just chatting and talking Irish traditions and stuff. And he's like, "It reminds me of a song," and he pulls out his guitar and he starts playing.
Wow.
So I was like, "This is." It was just such a cool.
That's great
atmosphere, man. I mean, it was really
that'll
really
be a good show.
I hope so.
Gosh, I want to interview him now. Listen, mine first. It'll be on.
He's the largest. He's huge. He's like 6'7".
Wow.
We took a picture together. I have to show you. But
his name's Odin. Of course, he's going to be 6'7".
Yeah, but he like puts his arm around me for the picture, and his whole hand takes up my whole shoulder.
Wow.
And I'm not a little fella. But I look like a little fella in that picture.
Wow.
That'd be on the website. I'll definitely put that on. Anyways, cool. I talk too much. See, that's what right. You should not ask me about.
No, that's good. That means you're involved in it and you're excited about it.
You know, I've got a book in my library. I think it's called Philosophy of Taste or Questions of Taste or something like that. But it's all about wine.
Oh,
and
I like
it's written by philosophers. And it's all about aesthetic philosophy and what alcohol does to the person's subjective states.
We need to get together for an episode.
Yeah.
Actually, that'd be pretty good.
Wouldn't that be fun? Yeah. For the three of us.
Philosophy and booze.
Yes, yeah. I'm all for it. I'm
so I think Roger Scruton may have
I should read that book first.
Contributed to that too. So, yeah,
he's a wonderful man, philosopher. Paul. Yeah. We should get together and drink and talk and record that. For
yeah, man. Episode. I'm on it, man.
Yeah, that'd be so much fun. Yeah.
Yeah, I think we, for the determinists, I don't know how they can own their decisions. All they can say is that their decisions are a product of prior decisions,
right,
in a chain of decisions and causes and and conditions and stuff like that. And so there's no sense in which they can own it because there's no self to own it. All there is a mass of nerve endings and psyche.
Would you
neurotransmitter this and that, you know, and that's all you get, you know?
Would you not agree that everything, every action since the Big Bang, and we'll say 500 milliseconds after the Big Bang, so we won't get into what caused that. Every action, meaning action, can be determined mathematically, given a set of rules and given a set of laws, which we have fundamental rules and laws in physics within this universe, that everything leading from that, much as you take a bottle of water and you dump it down a hill, you can mathematically determine where that water is going to go. Yeah. There is a mathematical equation.
Yes
to that.
And no, but there's also the Heisenberg principle, mm-hmm, of uncertainty.
I saw you put that on Facebook.
In physics, mm-hmm, yeah. And which was fascinating to me. And all that does is show that, well, Bayes' theorem is correct, you know, that probability is we take our best guess based on mathematical algorithms, but we can't have, and this is an epistemological question, that is, we can't have absolute...
What is that again? Can you remind me of that?
Epistemological question. Epistemology is the study of knowledge in terms of how we get it and how do we justify it as knowledge.
Okay.
And so when we talk about certainty, we're not talking about psychological certainty, we're talking about rational certainty, objective certainty, and certain, that kind of certainty really comes in degrees. It's not all or nothing. We can be relatively certain that based on these algorithms that thus and such will take place. The water will flow down the hill at this velocity and yada yada yada. But you know, there is a sense in which the more we know, the more we realize we don't know. And that's what the Heisenberg principle has taught us. Anybody on listening to this can Google it and find some fascinating
You're talking quantum yeah, mechanics and quantum, right, physics.
Right. Yeah. So yeah, we can narrow things down mathematically, but the most we can do with in terms of certainty is get to probability.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Not absolute.
The probability of where an electron will be, the probability of where a quark, right, will be.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And then if you wanted to play the game of the nominalist during the scholastic period, you could say numbers aren't real and math is out the window.
Right.
What makes two, two? I mean, really, who decided that?
So if that's true.
If numbers aren't real, as a nominalist maintained in the scholastic period in the 10th, 11th century, then...
Oh, I think math is one of the more... I love math. I think personally, I don't like to do it. But what I love about math is that there's the answer. And it is. It can be useful. There's the answer. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And 2 + 2 = 4. There's the answer. You can argue anywhere you want, but sure, that's the answer. And there's a little bit of... that's nice to have. But backing it up. So you're right. We take the macro world. We take the... planet Earth. We know it's going to go around the sun. We have a mathematical equation for that. We're trying to figure out why. We don't know really gravity, dark matter, where that plays into role, but we can kind of figure it out, and we figure it out through mathematics. And then we get into the quantum world and we say, ooh, things get weird there. And in fact, they just did an experiment recently where there's something called the spooky aspect of quantum mechanics. And they literally call it the spooky aspect. You can Google it. It's kind of neat. Where they confirmed, they could only capture so many of these, like, let's say, photons of light to study them. And a little of this is way beyond. I mean, this is like quantum mechanics, this is quantum physics. This is hard to grasp stuff. But basically, they figured out a way to fill in the loopholes that were missing in a lot of these experiments with quantum physics. Mm-hmm. And they basically concluded that, yes, it is spooky. The actions that these subatomic particles do are not beyond explanation, but they're more in the realm of we don't know what's going on here. One of the more amazing things is you take two, and this one's a little tricky to explain, but you take two, there's a term for it. It's, let's say married particles, married subatomic particles. They're connected. Not in physically connected, but they are connected as in if you had a pair of shoes, left shoe and a right shoe, they're connected.
So it's a relationship.
Mm-hmm. And if one is 5 feet away, or one is, I think in the experiment, one was a kilometer away, and then they did one at 80 kilometers away, the actions on one predicted the actions of the other without delay in time. So it was working faster than the speed of light. I said time, without the delay in speed of light. Mm-hmm. So they were able to predict what the other one was doing based on which one they were seeing without the time it takes to relay that message via electricity. And again, same thing as if you had a left shoe in your box and you open up and you look, I have a left shoe. I know they have a right shoe over there. So it's a little, it's mind bending stuff, yeah. But you're right. It's not, it's once you get to the micro aspect of mathematics and physics, it gets really, really weird.
Yeah, there's a lot we don't know. And while that doesn't necessarily prove free will, it does argue against determinism.
How so?
In terms of...
Because of the lack of definitive...
Because determinism is sort of a... it's like an epistemology on steroids. Mm-hmm. It's like there's no humility in determinism. Epistemological humility.
That okay.
Determinists insist that a series of causations or causes and conditions led up to this or that human agent making this decision.
Right.
They insist on that. But what they can't know is what exactly those prior conditions and causes are and what the relationship is between them.
You mean the exact causes?
Exactly. Yeah.
So
All the way back to, you know, the first cause or condition. It presupposes that, first of all, there is a relationship between every instantiation of every event, and that relationship is strictly cause and effect, which is only one of four possibilities for causation. Thank you, Aristotle. causation is not that simple either.
Right.
It only assumes a certain view of causation, and it assumes that there's a uniformity that moves throughout all of the universe as a domino effect, basically.
How could there...
We can't go back and determine what it was that...
That started it.
Yeah.
Or
four notches up, you can't determine.
Yeah. Where's the... And the break in the uniformity is the lack of knowledge as to what caused the ball moving.
Not only that, but how many balls there were involved for this ball to actually move, you know, for this domino to fall. How many dominoes were there? Was it, you know, 1,400 trillion, or was it, you know, 4 trillion?
In the world of...
They can't know that.
In the world of the compatibilist... Where is and the determinist would argue that where is the empirical data which suggests that you can make a choice and it's not based on everything that came prior to that moment? I mean, the ghost in the machine is fine, but there's no way to measure that ghost. We've never found a way to measure.
Okay, the statement you just made is, how do you know it's true that there is a ghost in the machine? I'm turning it around.
Okay.
Basically, and give me proof. Give me empirical evidence that there is a ghost in the machine. That was your question. essentially?
I guess, yeah.
Okay. So if that's your question, I would say that where is the evidence that there is truth? Give me the empirical data that something can be true. You can't. Because truth is not empirical. Truth is a relationship between a proposition and an actual state of affairs.
Right.
Okay. And that relationship is a metaphysical one. It has not an empirical property about it.
When you say truth,
can't measure it.
When you say truth, do you mean like the proof of a mathematical equation, or do you mean the truth in? I don't understand the.
Well, the truth in your statement that there. Well, in your the question presumes that there is a truth to be had about whether or not there's a ghost in the machine.
Right.
Your question presupposes that we can have certainty or reasonable certainty, mm-hmm. a degree of certainty about whether or not there's a ghost in the machine.
Right.
And so I can turn that around and say, give me empirical reasons to believe there isn't one.
Well, I mean, you can't prove that something doesn't exist. It's how do you prove that something doesn't exist? You can show the lack of evidence, but I guess.
Okay, so do you know your wife loves you?
We talked about this one. I can.
do I know my wife?
I'm certain. No, not, I'm not absolutely certain, but I am
relatively certain
right. that she does love yeah. me.
And, right. and we can entertain the logical possibility that she doesn't.
You know, right, yeah, sure.
That possibility is out there in terms of logic. But the fact that love is a metaphysical relationship between two subjects, mm-hmm. basically, and there's no mathematical proof for it. I can't measure it.
Right. Well, you could within, you know, as technology is able to scan fMRI and look at the pleasure sensors of the brain and the levels of dopamine.
I'm not arguing that the brain is not involved in love. I'm not right. arguing that. Mm-hmm. Indeed, as a compatibilist, I would maintain there is the empirical world that's involved, but it's not determinative.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And that's so really this is a discussion around not only epistemology but around metaphysics. What is really real? How do we know what we know?
Mm-hmm.
Which is the business of metaphysics and epistemology. That's really what this is all about. And so how do we know
what free will is all about?
Well, yeah. Free will is a metaphysical problem.
Right, right.
It is.
Yeah.
And when the determinists say that all we are is a material thing made up of neurons, protons, electrons, and whatever else ons.
99.9999% nothing, too. Keep that one in mind.
Ah.
Because if you think about the empty space that's in a in an atom, we're really just a bunch of clouds sitting around here. It's really creepy when you think about it.
Dead air.
Yeah. But it's true. So
we're a composite of nothing and something.
That's right. So my wife asked me the other day, what does a blind person dream about? And there's actually a guy on YouTube. He was blind from birth, and he answers all these questions. It's fantastic. I wish I could remember his name. I'd give him a plug. But he basically answers all the questions you have for a blind person. What do they dream about? What are they? And the same idea comes with, well, in our world of six or five senses, what would a world of six senses entail? I don't know. There's no way you can predict that. It doesn't exist to us. You can't dream in a sixth sense if there is no sixth sense. I mean, it's beyond our imagination. Every time I have a discussion with Paul, I try to think four minutes ahead of myself, and then that those 2 minutes I have down pat, and then the other two, because they're too far away, I forget. And that was the reason why I was bringing this up. But unfortunately, at this point, it's gone.
That's all right.
That's why I had I had four or five pages of notes that were beautifully handwritten and sitting at my desk right now, which I was going over at lunchtime, and the cleaning staff that cleans my office is probably looking at it going, what does this guy do here? I'm reading Ghost in the Machine, Libertarian. Yeah.
That's awesome.
So,
I remember what I was going to get at. So, we only can perceive what we see in our natural world at the, we could say the macroscopic level, it doesn't matter at our level, you know, at our ratio of existence. What I mean by that is everything we perceive is only what we can comprehend, which is what light gives us, which sound gives us, which our senses tell us is going on. So we see, like I see Mike, I see the table, I can feel the table. All this is very physical and very, very here. When you start talking about the actual reality in which we live in, most of it, you know, empty space, that's where... Damn it, I lost my train of thought again. I'm sorry. It's all right. I had a point there.
Let me offer, if I could,
sure.
a few concerns that could be raised against determinists.
Okay. And I'm just saying that when I read determinisms or the deterministic view, I say, okay, that makes more sense to me. I'm not a staunch determinist. Because I'm a pretty hardcore libertarian, but all this is open for discussion, and this is one of the reasons why I brought up the Wait What If podcast, and it is part of my exploration of life and which brings us, sure. You know, and this is fantastic.
And we're all on the same journey, by the way.
But see,
none of us are
as I reach my late 30s and as I approach 40, I find that, do you remember when you were in high school or when you were in middle school, the eighth graders, when you were a fifth grader, or the seniors, when you were a freshman, they seemed... There was like an awe about them. They were like the old, they knew what they were doing. They were adults. They looked, you know, maybe they had mustaches or something. I was, you know, 80s. That was cool then. But now that I'm approaching those years, it's spread out, because 4 years as a 10-year-old is a large chunk of your life versus 4 years as a 38-year-old. So if you spread that out, what I see my father, my father-in-law, and now you're falling into that category, the 60-year-old folks, I see you guys as the seniors in life. Oh. and I like these discussions because you have what I'm about to experience. You've already gone through it. And, which is why I get into long conversations with my father-in-law and with my father. Yeah. And because I like to get that aspect where, as a freshman, I went to it because I didn't care. I was just trying to figure out my way around high school.
Well, it's fun to continue to learn, that's for sure. And that process goes on forever. And none of us have arrived. None of us. With Socrates, I can say for sure that the only thing I know is that I don't know. So some of the problems with determinism would include morality would be negatively affected. Morality becomes merely social convention or agreed upon principles.
Morality, right.
Morality. Mm-hmm. That tend to provide some survival advantage to the human species. Mm-hmm. If all human actions are causally determined by prior causes and conditions, then no one is morally responsible for their actions. So that's one concern. Another concern is truth is compromised. If my material processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms. So says J.B. Haldane. So do we see the problem with that? I'm going to read that again.
Right, no.
If my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing that my brain is composed of atoms. You see, truth is compromised by determinism. Also, coherence suffers. What precisely is the material antecedent cause of the non-material, seemingly a priori assumption that causation is real? You see, causation is an a priori assumption, as David Hume has so eloquently insisted, and to this date is so true. No one has ever seen a cause. Oh, there it goes. No, you've never seen a cause. Causation itself is an a priori assumption.
An a priori assumption means
means that it's not physical, it's not seen or observed in the empirical, tangible world.
Because you could back it up indefinitely.
It's a mental construct. It's a mental construct.
The person who slams on their brakes because of a dog and causes an accident, you could say the dog caused it, but then you back up, well, the person who didn't shut their gate caused it, and then you could back it up in the person.
But all of that assumes causation, which itself is not a physical, tangible brain state. Causation is a relationship between two things. And a relationship between two things itself is a metaphysical aspect.
I would argue that
physical one.
A brain state would be a causation.
Well, the brain, again, for the compatibilist, I wouldn't argue. The brain state can trigger something and provide the necessary conditions under which I would choose X and Y. That doesn't mean because there's a cause involved that I'm determined to do that, given options. That gets into other things. But another concern about causation is that it's oversimplified in determinism. Determinism oversimplifies causation. I'd said this previously. Aristotle taught us well that causation actually comes in four different kinds. There's a formal cause, a material cause, an efficient cause, and a final cause. Mike, I'm sure you've heard this before in your philosophy classes. And so causation is not simply the efficient cause, which is the way in which determinists talk about causation, is that you have one event and one product or consequent of that event. So causation is oversimplified. And I could go on and on and on. There's a plethora of concerns that I have with determinism that caused me to not jump in bed with it and commit to it. I have less faith in that or belief or conviction about that as being coherent and existentially viable. So it's not logically consistent, it's not existentially viable, and it's not empirically adequate. It doesn't answer, which is my construct for all of reality and for my beliefs, as I said previously on another podcast. So,
does that make sense? Oh, no.
Ooh. Are we back? Yeah. We had a little bit of a technical difficulty. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
We're still recording, though, right?
Better check. Yeah, because this audio sounds too good right now. Yeah, we're still recording.
Oh, good. Man. Good. So, and there are other problems. There are problems also with libertarianism that I could raise. And truth be told, there are problems with compatibilists as well. And I'm aware of some of them. But at the end of the day, for me, the three options, compatibilist is the one that's most logically consistent, is empirically adequate. It explains the physical material world that I live in, and it's existentially viable. I can live consistently with a belief in compatibilism and not live a lie, basically, which is something we kind of all want to do, I think.
Sure. So. Can you read the first quote that you had on there again? I just want to bring something up on that.
Oh, sure. That we opened the show with?
No, that you had right here.
J.B. Haldane?
Yes.
Yes. He says, if my mental processes are determined wholly by the motions of atoms in my brain, I have no reason to suppose that my beliefs are true, and hence I have no reason for supposing my brain to be composed of atoms.
Right. So his thinking there is that...
Oops.
Hey, I have a new sound. I have a new soundboard. Listen to this guy. This is when something that I don't quite grasp or that I'm having trouble with, I go,
uh-oh.
That's my son.
I love it.
That's my son.
Uh-oh.
Let me use that one more.
I want that for my ringer.
Yeah.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And then I have this one too. This one is at some point, and this can be true when I was in grad school and someone was up there going, the posterior part of the brainstem is most, this is what was going on in my head.
A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K, L, M, N, O, P, Q, R, S, T, U, V, W, X, Y, and Z. Now I know my ABCs. Next time we'll see.
So when I went to my father-in-law and I said, I was wondering if I could ask you if I could have your daughter's hand in marriage. Well, Kevin, life is full of this is what went through my head. So with that said,
which is merely a brain state.
So with that said, a lot of this discussion got that in the back of my head, but it opened up a lot of thought. I think, and of course, I mean, what are we at? Year 2015, and what year did Aristotle teach? In
437, roughly.
Okay, so a little while ago.
BCE.
Yeah. And then, but Plato, he was...
he was just prior to that, about 7 years or so.
Okay, so basically the same amount of time. Yeah. So we're talking 2,500 years ago. I didn't think we were going to come up with the answer just sitting around here. But if we did, that'd be fantastic. Because exactly. I would probably get a huge listener base and then get some sponsors out of it. But no, I think, I mean, it brings up some good thoughts, and I think this is a great discussion.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
The last one, I think the last time we did this, we were in my garage. And it was probably just the end of the springtime, or it might have been just getting, because I think we had the garage door open, and look at, we moved up in the world. Now we're inside my, I don't know what we'd call this, my broadcast studio, my podcast studio. I hope you enjoyed the discussion tonight.
Oh, indeed.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Is there anything else you think you want to bring up? Do you think we can piggyback this discussion? What I'm really surprised at, and I wonder for Christian apologists, which I would say that you are in that camp, correct?
That was what my graduate work was done in.
Okay. A discussion of free will, and I purposely didn't bring this up because I didn't want to go there, but are you surprised that I didn't say, if there's an omniscient God...
Yep. No. I'm fully prepared to discuss that, but by no means do we need to. I don't think it's necessary.
I think it's one of the bigger questions that people have out there.
Sure it is. It's a reasonable question.
And it's, I would dare to say, impossible to wrap your mind around.
Well, it is, unless you buy into Bill Craig's, he's been a staunch defender of a certain kind of knowledge that God has, that a 16th century French philosopher came up with called Louis de Molina, and it's called Molinism. But in a nutshell, it maintains that God has all knowledge of past, present, future, and here we go, and contingent.
What does that mean?
What could have been but would not be.
Okay.
So it could have been the case that I could have chosen to diss this podcast, stay at home and watch Oprah reruns. Mm-hmm. That could have been a case, an option to me. It was open to me to do that. Or I could have stayed at home and had a second beer, you know, and not come. But I didn't. And so Craig and Molina argue that God has that kind of knowledge as well. And given that God has that kind of knowledge, then there's really not much of a conflict between God knowing in advance what choices will be made and the choices that are made.
So he knows every possibility.
Right.
And that would fall right into the parallel universe idea or the parallel timeline.
Yeah, but boy, most philosophers just don't go there. They don't ascribe to that at all.
Even the parallel time frame? You choose A over B, that A still happened in a large enough... enough in an infinite world of possibility.
My understanding is most philosophers see too many problems with that.
Yeah.
They're trying to deal with the actual world.
Mm-hmm. I guess you have to. You have to, because the rest is...
That's the only one we got.
Yeah, right. Yeah, exactly.
There's too much to talk about right here. Why am I going to worry about...
Right, yeah, right.
And that's true. That's because at that point, you're just kind of winging it, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. And there's some biblical text that suggests that God has that kind of knowledge. Just briefly, 1 Samuel 23, David, King David, is running away from Saul, the current king of Israel, and he's in the desert. And he ends up in this little desert town called Keilah. And Saul's spies find out that David's in Keilah. So David learns that the spies are in town, and they know they're going to go back to Saul and tell Saul that David's in Keilah. So David prays and asks God, God, if the spies go back, they tell Saul, and Saul comes to Keilah. Here we go, 1 Samuel 23, verse 7. Will the inhabitants of Keilah give me over to him? And God says, yep, they sure will. David said, thank you very much. I'm out of here. I'm paraphrasing, of course. But basically, he leads Keilah. Mm-hmm. And Saul's spies tell him that David leads, and Saul never goes to Keilah. That never occurred. How did God know what would have happened if thus and such were to occur, if he did not have that kind of middle knowledge or contingent knowledge?
Right. Hmm.
And only an omniscient being could have all of the possibilities as well as the actualities configured within his mind such that he knows precisely what will come about given whatever conditions.
And that might even be compatible with the non-theistic view of if you are within the realm of our universe and we're held within our own physical constraints, if there is another world or there is an area of where time and space doesn't matter. And then this goes back to what I was saying with you can only perceive what you can perceive. You can't perceive beyond what our senses have. That a individual, whether it be a deity or whatever, that it can exist beyond what we comprehend as a linear time. A perpetual existence makes no sense to us, that something can live in every moment all at once. And does that make sense to you?
Yeah.
And I think that makes sense there, that if you consider us living on a straight line, the idea of God would be living in a bowl of water. We can only comprehend what's on that straight line that only goes one direction, doesn't go the other way.
Right.
Bowl of water is flowing. It goes up, it goes down, it goes left, it goes right, and it's there all at once.
Yeah. There's two views about God's relationship to time. He's atemporal, that is, he's outside of time. Actually, there's three. He's atemporal, he's outside of time. He sort of has the bird's eye view on everything. Or he's temporal, he's always in time because time is eternal. Or B is a hybrid, that he's outside of time, but when time began at the Big Bang, God entered into, his relationship to time changed, and he became related to time in a way that otherwise he did not, because time did not exist prior to the Big Bang. And that's got a lot of credence. Bill Craig has written some fascinating, very technical articles on that, some of which are available on his website. But
well, I hope in the next 20 something years I figure something out. At this point I'm just
when
playing.
You do, let me know.
Paul can be I follow you on Twitter at Inchristos.
Oh, you do?
Yeah.
Okay.
C-H-R-I-S-T-O-S or
I-N-C-H-R-I-S-T-U-S.
Okay.
Inchristos. It's Latin for in Christ.
Okay.
Biblical expression.
And you have a blog too, right?
I do. It's in Christus, Inchristus, Inchristus.com. So
okay,
yeah.
And then, are you published? Did I hear you?
You know, yeah, sort of.
Okay,
I got a few articles. I just had a book review published in Philosophia Christi, and it's a philosophical journal.
Okay,
and I've actually published an article in that as well many years ago. And I've published a series of magazine articles.
So. Fantastic.
But that's about it. No books.
Okay. Well, maybe eventually you're working on one?
You know, I've been encouraged to, but I haven't.
Yeah.
No, I haven't been.
Well, it's your choice whether you want to. With that said. So I hope you enjoyed the Wait, What If podcast, number 16. We talked about free will with, now I don't know who to say first. Paul Adams and Mike Stojic. Mike Stojic and Paul Adams. We had a good time. Obviously, we came up with nothing. I honestly want to know, though, when you go home, do you shake your head and go, it's all hope is lost? Or do you say, that was a good conversation. I think I've shed a little light on. I hope you shed a little light on. I think you did. Anyways, you can reach us at waitwhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Please send us a message, critique, whatever you want. Let us hear it. On top of that, you can follow us on Facebook / WWI Podcast or on Twitter, which I don't really tweet too much every now and then. And that's at WWI Podcast. Thank you so much for listening. This is a fun little hobby, and I wouldn't do it if I didn't have anyone download and listen. So thank you for listening. And until next time.
I would have to go to